Back again to the Bad Quaker podcast, where liberty is our mission. This podcast will likely be broadcasted on Wednesday, March 20th, 2013, and it's going to be podcast number 285. And the reason I said it like that is because we're pre-recording with an interview today. But before I get to that, I have a couple of announcements, the ones that I've been pushing pretty heavily here lately. Get out to New Hampshire for Pork Fest 10. That's going to be June 17th through 23rd, 2013, at the Rogers Campground in Lancaster, New Hampshire. And thanks very much to the Free State Project for setting that up and doing it every year. I'm going to be speaking on Monday and Friday of Pork Fest, and my two topics will be central planning versus spontaneous order, and discovering and defeating statist thinking. I'm not sure which will be Monday and which will be Friday. But if you can, get out there to Pork Fest. It is a lot of fun. It's a really casual atmosphere. It's everything from a very adult-oriented all the way to very family-oriented, according to what you want to be a part of. The campground is very big, and you can segment yourself however you want. There's every aspect of the liberty movement, from minarchist to anarchist and everything in between out there. So get on out to Pork Fest. And the other announcement was for Seacoast Annual Freedom Expo, Saturday, April 27th, 2013, also in New Hampshire, in Exeter, New Hampshire, at the Exeter Town Hall. It's a free event. You don't have to sign up ahead of time. Just get out there on April 27th and have a blast. Okay, now, Michael Humer is with me today. Michael is the professor of philosophy at the University of Colorado Boulder. Michael, welcome to the Bad Quaker podcast. I'm so happy to have you on.
Thank you. By the way, I wanted to mention about the Porcupine Festival in June. I'm going to be there too.
Really?
Yes.
That's great news.
I'll probably be speaking on Tuesday and Wednesday, so we can meet in person.
Wow, that would be great. Maybe we can record another one of these interviews. That's going to be great. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
Now, to kind of give folks a little bit of a background, you're not just some wacko, that happened to have got hired by the University of Colorado. Right. Michael has proper degrees. He's a real live, educated person. Well, I've seen a few people tending toward anarchy that have come out of Berkeley, but you got your PhD from Rutgers.
Yes.
That's not exactly, there's not a whole lot of radical thought going on there, is there?
No, I don't think so. Rutgers was not very big on political philosophy at the time, so I was on my own. But really, I became an anarchist when I was in college at Berkeley. And the reason for that was that Brian Kaplan was there, and we were classmates, and so he introduced me to anarcho-capitalism.
I believe he's down at Georgetown now, isn't he? Not Georgetown.
George Mason.
George Mason, that's right. Yeah, yeah. George Mason, the founding father or patriot or however you want to refer to him, is one of my favorite almost anarchists.
Yeah.
He was so close. If they just had thought the theories out a little bit better, he would have been right there.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, my listeners, I started to say folks, but specifically my listeners might know you, if they don't already know your name, they might know you from a TED Talk that you gave. I really enjoyed that TED Talk. It was about, I think it was about 15 minutes long, but I was, I would have been happy if it would have been a two-hour TED.
Yeah, I was ready to speak about it for an hour, but they would only let me talk for 15 minutes. I've spoken about political irrationality in the past, and, you know, I have an hour-long talk about that. I had to squeeze it down.
And in that, you were talking about how people tend to not act rationally when they or not think rationally when they're thinking about politics.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, this is something that Brian Kaplan also talks about. It's mostly because people know that they are not going to suffer the actual consequences of their political beliefs. Because you know that if you adopt an incorrect political belief, that is not actually going to cause your society to change, right? Because you'll probably have almost no effect. So there's not really the incentive for people to think carefully and become informed about political issues.
I think that's a really good way of putting that. I have kind of talked about it in the same context that it's, you know, you're separating the consequences from the action. And yeah, when you do that on a societal level, you're creating a pretty nasty thing.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I claim that the problem of political irrationality is the worst social problem, right? It's the most important social problem because it's the problem that prevents us from solving all of the other problems.
Yeah, and if you think about it, you know, some of the arguments against the idea of not having a government to, you know, to guide us or whatever the excuse is, some of the arguments are, well, you know, look how people act when they, you know, gang members or crime or this kind of thing. But if you think about it, some of the worst actions in history have not been done on the individual level. They've been done on a governmental level.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, no individual has ever killed over a million people, right, acting alone. The only way that you can commit a really large-scale disaster is with the force of the state. There's, you know, there were some statistics that I looked at when I was reading, when I was doing the research for the book, and, you know, something like 150 million people were killed by their own governments in the 20th century. And that's not counting the people who were killed by foreign governments during wartime.
Wow. In your new book, your book came out in January. It's titled The Problem of Political Authority, An Examination of the Right to Coerce and the Duty to Obey. And essentially, you confront those two major myths, that the government has the right to force us to obey its laws and that we have the duty to obey those laws. Explain that that thought. Well, you know, don't tell the whole book, but explain that thought to my listeners a little bit.
Yeah, well, I noticed that the government does a lot of things that would be considered clearly wrong if anyone else were to do them. So if I decided I was collecting money for a charity and I wasn't getting enough voluntary contributions, so I'm just going to force people to contribute to my charity. You know, if I were to go out and start mugging people or extorting money from people, even though it's for a good cause, most people would say that that was wrong, right? Almost everyone would say that that was wrong, including both Democrats and Republicans and libertarians. So why is the state allowed to do that? So that's roughly the problem about political legitimacy. It is the question about why the government is entitled to coerce people. At the same time, most people would think that they would not be obligated to obey me if I told them, you know, hand over your money. Maybe it would be a nice thing to do to hand over some money to help the poor or whatever cause that I have. But few people would think that they were morally obligated just because I told them. Right. Similarly, the government tells people what they can and can't consume. So certain substances are illegal because they're bad for your health. Almost no one would think that they were obligated to obey me if I started telling them, you know, don't consume these unhealthy substances. So again, the question is, well, why should you obey the state? Why is the state different from everybody else?
And there's a practical outworking on this too, I think, that, you know, if you're, how do I put this? One way I always say it is that according to what you're aiming at, you know, if you're aiming at a target, let's say you're target practicing and you're aiming at a target, you have a whole lot greater likelihood to hit that target, the bullseye on the target, if you're actually aiming at it. But if you're, you know, if you're aiming near it, then you shouldn't be shocked if you don't hit the target. And when it comes to morality, you know, we can look at the government and we can say, well, it doesn't matter what you think, you know, what your intention is, If you're going to be using government to accomplish your means, then you're using that aggression. You're using that that assumption of the right to coerce. You're using that to accomplish your means. So if morality is your goal, you're not shooting at it to begin with.
Yeah, good point. Yeah. I mean, one of the things I think about is, well, I'm advocating such a radical position, basically a purely voluntary society. You might think, well, this is too radical of a position. It's not going to be possible to attain it. So why don't we aim for something more feasible in the nearer future? But I will point out that there have been large social changes in the past that happened because of idealists, right? Sometimes for the better and sometimes for the worse. But we didn't abolish slavery because a lot of people were saying we should slightly improve the conditions of slaves, right? It got abolished because there were people who took this kind of fundamentalist position that it's an inherently unjust institution that had to be abolished. On the other side, on the side of a bad social change, the communists did not succeed in taking over so many countries because they advocated incremental change. It was because they advocated this complete radical reordering of society. So my hope is that by advocating a radical position, I'm more likely to cause actual social change.
I would have to agree with that, and those are two opposite sides of the coin, but they're two really good examples of why slow, gradual change may not be the best option for us. You know, I'd like to believe that we could just vote in the right people and everything would work great and the government would shrink down to a tiny little size where it would be easy to crush and we could just throw it away and start all over new.
Yeah.
But I'm a little bit more of a realist than that. I can't imagine government allowing that to take place.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the reasons for the failures of democratic governments are not just accidental. It's not that we accidentally voted for the wrong people. There's something built into the system. Namely, nobody has an incentive to fix the system. Voters don't have sufficient incentive to become informed about all the thousands and thousands of things the government is doing all the time, right? Because you know that your individual vote is extremely unlikely to make any difference, right? So why would you just devote your life to researching the things the government is doing? At the same time, the politicians who are running the government don't have any incentive to do any better because they know that nobody's paying attention to what they're doing. They're being lobbied by special interest groups. And, you know, we have this funny system where it's like there's not really anybody whose fault it is because the politicians kind of have to cater to the special interests. Otherwise, they will not get reelected because they will not get enough campaign funding. The special interest groups are kind of forced to lobby the government because they know that if they don't do it, their competitors will. And the voters kind of don't have that much choice because each voter knows that if they go and do research on what the politicians are up to, it's not going to make any difference, just their individual vote, right? So it's kind of like, well, it's the fault of the system. It's the way the system is arranged. It's arranged so that the government doesn't serve the interests of most people.
Are you familiar with the works of Hans Hermann Hoppe?
Not very much.
He has an interesting thought that he's kind of fleshed out, and I was really impressed with it. He talks about people in government being caretakers, and he actually compared monarchs in the olden days with the current types of democratic governments that we have. And he showed that even though, you know, monarchs could be cruel and horrible, and it was, you know, there was many aspects of that that was bad. But if you had a good monarch, an honest monarch, He showed ownership over his people and over the land and over the country and everything.
Yeah.
But and he had a personal incentive to improve the situation and hand something better to his children. But today's democratic politicians are like a caretaker, and all of their economic incentives are to loot as much as possible within the time frame that they're in office. because their time frame is limited. So they're kind of like the difference between when you rent a car or when you own a car. And the current politicians are kind of like, you know, treating government in general the way a person treats a rental car.
Yeah. Yeah, probably the clearest example of this is with the federal debt, right? Each generation of politicians just borrows more money because they can leave the debt to the next generation of politicians. And so we've been doing this for generations, and now we have the $14 trillion or whatever it is, $14 trillion debt. And because the voters aren't all that informed, when things finally go south, they're going to blame whatever politicians are in office at the time, not the ones who were in office 20 years ago. If anyone knows whose fault it was, it'll be too late to punish those people anyway.
That's a really good point. I'm going to go ahead and break for our first commercial here. And when we get back, I want to ask you about ethical intuitionism.
Great.
Folks, I'll be right back after this commercial.
From June 17th through June 23rd of this year, the Free State Project will celebrate its 10th annual Porcupine Freedom Festival, Porkfest. My wife Cindy and I plan on attending, and Bad Quicker staff members Hannah and Matt are trying to raise enough money to attend, as they did last year. Considering fuel, campground fees, and Porkfest tickets, we estimate it will cost BadQuaker.com a little over $2,000 for Cindy and I to attend. For Matt and Hannah to attend, it will cost about $700 more. If you'd like to take part in sending the Bad Quaker crew to Porkfest 10, here's how you can do it. Go to BadQuaker.com. You can click on the donate button on the right-hand side of the page. You can also give us bitcoins with our bitcoin number located right below the donate button, or you can use our Amazon button to shop at Amazon. If you'd like to support BadQuaker.com on a regular basis, you can use the link to our forum and become a supporting member for only $4 a month or just $25 a year. Thanks, folks.
Want caviar sound on a cat food budget? Creamy Radio Audio by the Freedom Fiends has great free tips so you can sound like a pro without spending like one. The most powerful form of human communication is one person speaking to another. But if people have to suffer through your sound, they'll change the channel and miss your message. With articles on microphones, preamps, recorders, mastering, recording remotely over the internet, doing a podcast, even getting a show on actual radio, the Freedom Fiends show you what they use and where to get it. Whether you're a talk show host, voiceover artist, podcaster, evangelist, or just want to record your loved ones for the ages, at Creamy Radio Audio, the Freedom Fiends will help you make the most of your sound. Creamy Radio Audio will help you speak to the world with sound that will make people want to keep listening. Check out creamyradioaudio.com. That's creamyradioaudio.com.
And thanks for sticking with me through the commercial. This is Ben Stone with Bad Quaker Podcast with Michael Humer, professor of philosophy at the University of Colorado Boulder. And I did want to mention, you know, Boulder is such a nice town. A lot of people go through Denver and they just pass right through it. Yeah. And they never get to see the beauty of Boulder because it sits up there kind of like against the foothills and out of the way. But it's a really nice place.
Yes, it is. Yeah, I mean, I like Denver, but Boulder is even nicer. It's we're right at the base of the mountain, so we have a nice view.
Is it really windy there a lot?
Frequently, yeah, it is.
That tends to be the signature of living next to big mountains like that.
Yeah, that's right. Periodically, the weather breaks over the mountains, so we can have a sunny day and then a snow day the next day.
Now, you had one of your books is called Ethical Intuitionism. Can you describe that for our listeners?
So, well, the book is about kind of about the nature of values and nature of evaluative beliefs. So there are a number of questions. There's how do we know what's right and wrong or what's good and bad? Is there an objective right and wrong? Are there objective values? And ethical intuitionism is this view that was, well, it was popular in the early 20th century, and then it went out of favor. And some people, including me, are trying to bring it back. The intuitionists think that there are objective values, and our knowledge of them comes from something called ethical intuition. This ethical intuition is It's understood as a kind of rational insight into the nature of values, that when you think about certain evaluative questions, there's something that just seems right to you. And my claim is that unless you have positive grounds for doubting that intuition, it constitutes justification for believing that things are, in fact, as they appear. So, for example, I can tell this story. Let's say there's a patient who need. There are five patients who need organ transplants, and you have one patient who happens to have five healthy organs. And I ask, so would it be correct to kill the healthy patient to distribute his organs to the five others? In that way, although one person would die, you could save five people's lives. And when I describe this scenario, almost everyone has an intuitive reaction. So you have the reaction that, no, that seems wrong. And so unless there's some positive ground for doubting that intuition, I say, well, that's good enough for us to be justified in thinking that, in fact, it is wrong.
I've made the argument, and I think it's along the same lines, but I'm not as thorough a thinker as you are, so feel free to correct me here. But I've made the argument that, you know, you take something like a butterfly, and it's living in the jungles of central Mexico, and it gets this urge, and it takes off, and it flies all the way to the plains of central Canada, and then it turns around and flies all the way back to the same tree in central Mexico. And it does all that without really thinking about it and without anyone instructing it on how to do that.
Yeah.
And my argument is, if a butterfly has that kind of hardwiring in its being, yeah, it comes to it somehow other than through the learning mechanism, that humans must have some type of at least an outline of how to live and how to you know, interact with one another on a basis that is most successful for our species. Is that kind of along the same lines?
Well, so I think there's one thing that's similar and something that's different. I don't think that the correct moral values are innate or genetically programmed in the way that the butterfly's instinct is genetically programmed. But the thing that I think is similar is, very frequently we know something without being able to say how we know it. And your inability to explain how you know something, or inability to give an argument for it, doesn't mean that you don't know it. And in fact, that's true of probably almost everything that you know. You can't really give a full account of how you know it. So, for example, you call me on the telephone, I pick up, you say hello, and just from that, I recognize who it is, right? Somebody asked me, okay, you know, describe Ben Stone's voice such that somebody who hasn't heard him before would be able to recognize him. I could not do that, right? I would not be able to describe how I recognized your voice, but that clearly doesn't mean that I don't recognize him, right? So I do want to say there are lots of things that we know that we can't explain how we know them. I don't want to say that moral values are genetically programmed. And one of the reasons for this is that our human beings' moral values and behavior have changed a lot, like dramatically, over human history, and in a way that has gotten much, much better than it used to be, right? And so if it was genetically determined, we couldn't really explain this amount of moral progress.
Now, in your other book, it's called Skepticism and the Veil of Perception. Explain what the concept there is.
Well, yeah. So, I wrote that book shortly after I became a professor, and it was kind of based upon my dissertation. I'd been worried about how people know about the external world. Now, really, my initial interest in philosophy was I wanted to get to how we know about values, but I started to realize that there were all of these arguments for moral skepticism. I started to realize that they were actually just parallel to arguments for skepticism in general and skepticism about the external world. Okay, so I decided, well, I'm going to figure out the basic thing first. How do we know about the external world, right? And so the book defends what's called direct realism. It's the idea that we have direct awareness of external objects when we have perceptual experiences. and we're justified in believing in the external objects, and we don't need any kind of inference or argument to be justified in believing in the things that we perceive.
Jumping back, I hate to jump from book to book like this on you. I'm sorry about that, but a thought popped into my head about the about your book, The Problem of Political Authority.
Yeah.
When we consider, you know, your statement that if a person acted like a government, almost everybody would consider it immoral and intolerable. They wouldn't put up with it.
And I
think what, and maybe this is on my mind because I was talking about it for Tuesday's podcast, so it was already floating around in my brain. But what a lot of people get confused about is when they see two different things, and there's a confusion between the difference in kind and difference in degree. And so an example of that is where somebody says something like, well, the United States government is functioning from an economic point of view in a fascist manner, in the sense that the government utilizes influence over corporations and over private companies and so forth, and it gives favoritism to some corporations over others, and in return, many of those corporations support specific politicians legally, but in ways that give them a favorable situation. So when we compare the United States government and say it's acting in a economically fascist point of view, that doesn't mean they're Nazis. It's a difference in degree and a difference in kind. The kind might be the same in the sense that they're both fascist, but the degree, the United States government doesn't, of course, round up ethnic groups and have them killed. At that, but that's a degree problem. It's not a kind problem.
Yeah. So in fairness, the U.S. government is much better than the great majority of governments that have existed throughout history. Less tyrannical. We kill fewer people. Usually the people that the government kills, the people that the U.S. government kills, are foreigners rather than its own citizens. So if the government is going to kill a million people, it's going to be a million people in the Middle East rather than here. And so I guess that makes it better than the governments that kill their own people. Well, that's kind of hard to say. But, you know, there is still this problem that we have a group of people who are giving orders to everyone else and forcing everyone else to obey them. And I just don't understand where those people get the right to do that.
Or the responsibility for us all to obey all that and tolerate it.
Yeah, I don't understand why I should obey those people. And I wouldn't obey anyone else who was giving those commands.
I often talk about how this boils even down to the city level, where, you know, what we were talking about earlier, that the responsibility for your actions is separated from the actions themselves. That's one of the functions that keeps people loving government. And this boils all the way down to a city level where, you know, you don't like what somebody else has got in their yard, so you call the city and complain rather than deal with it on a personal level. Because, you know, if you go walking over to your neighbor's house and you say, hey, I think that bush is ugly, you should cut it, then you're going to suffer the repercussion of your neighbor thinking you're a nut.
Yeah.
But if you call the city and say, well, you know, this other person's bush on their property is lowering the value of my property, can't you make him trim it or something? Then you've taken the punish aspect out of the confrontation and put it off to somebody else.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's a kind of game theoretic point to make here, right? If you decide to try to mess with your neighbor personally, you know, both of you probably have comparable power to each other. So you can't really expect to be able to force your neighbor to do your bidding. But the members of the government are in a different situation. They can just force people to do whatever they want, and they're pretty much immune to retaliation. So if the government makes completely unreasonable demands, they can just force people to obey them, and the people can't retaliate effectively. And so when you have that situation, they probably will make unreasonable demands, or they will probably just not particularly care about the interests of the other people they're dealing with. Whereas you probably will have to take into account the interests and rights of the other individuals that you're interacting with, because you don't have the power to just force them to do whatever you want.
Now, you said that you were going to go to Porkfest, and that's really good news. I'm glad to hear that. Do you have topics yet?
Well, not completely sure. I mean, I'm going to talk about things related to the book and hopefully promote it and get people to buy more copies of it. I'm not sure exactly.
So what I might tell my listeners is normally I would encourage them to hit the Amazon links on my page and buy, the book of the author that I'm talking to. But in this case, if the listener is going to Porkfest, I'm sure you're going to be signing copies there, right?
I don't have a lot of copies to bring with me, so you can the listeners should buy their own copies.
Okay, so they can do that then. They can hit my Amazon link, buy it, and that'll help me and you, and then they can stop at Porkfest and have you sign it for them.
Yeah, that would be great.
Now, in your TED Talk, and they only gave you 15 minutes. That's kind of, I don't want to be paranoid about this kind of thing, but it seems like, were they afraid that if they let you talk too much, the cat would be out of the bag?
No, 15 minutes is kind of the standard length. Actually, it's a little bit long for TED Talks. They have some that are 10 minutes or less. There's a limited attention span. I mean, it was an event in Denver where they had multiple different people coming up and giving short spots. So, and I was actually one of the longer ones.
Well, it was really good to that at least they allowed you that much time, because TED has a really wide audience.
Yeah. This is TED has these franchises, and so there's a franchise in Denver. Basically, what happened was one of the people who was organizing the event ran into my webpage, and he found my essay about irrationality, and so he wrote to me. And so we started talking, and wound up with him inviting me to give a talk about it.
Now, if you look ahead, from your perspective and from what you've seen so far, how would you project ahead and say what you would expect the world to look like in, say, 50 years or maybe 100 years?
Right, yeah. Well, the first thing to say about all questions like that is nobody knows, right? And just to emphasize that and to convince you of that, think about how the world was 100 years in the past. 100 years ago, imagine that you took the time machine, you went back to the people 100 years ago, and you asked somebody, what do you think the world will look like in 2013? How accurate do you think their predictions would be?
Pretty bad.
Yeah. Obviously, nobody would have any idea. Nobody would have predicted the computer revolution, right? And here's another thing, thinking back 50 years ago, in science fiction stories, 50 years or more ago, how much of a role did computers play? Practically none, right?
Right.
Computers were doing
right.
practically nothing. So what I can predict is stuff will happen that we can't now predict, right? There will be new technologies that nobody now knows about, and they're going to change our lives in ways that we can't predict because we don't know what they are. Now, what will the political situation be like? That's also hard to predict. I don't know whether we're going to go in a more statist direction or a more libertarian direction. I try to strike an optimistic note at the end of the book because I think there has been enormous progress, moral progress over human history, which is often forgotten. It's easy for us to look at the recent past and say, well, the government has been expanding its powers, so, it's going to get worse in the future. Right? But remember things like 150 years ago or 200 years ago, we were practicing slavery. That is a pretty serious infringement of liberty, much worse than anything that's going on in America today. Just 40 years ago, a large portion of the world was communist and dominated by the Soviet Union. And so the collapse of the Soviet Union was an enormous step in favor of more liberty. Unfortunately, the U.S. government has become, you know, more powerful and more extensive. But if you kind of, you know, look at the world overall, it does kind of look like things are getting better.
I would think if you had the view of, let's say, if you were, I'm early 50s, so I have a pretty good memory of the 1960s. If I were sitting in, say, central China, and if I'd lived my whole life in central China, my view of the world and my view of liberty and my view of the government, I would be saying, man, things are doing great. We're going, you know, the whole world's going in the right direction, it would seem to me, you know.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, if you take into account what's happening in the more tyrannical parts of the world, it looks good, right? The Chinese government is still not a free country, but they are getting better. And, you know, all of these other communist countries in Eastern Europe, they turned capitalist.
Even to a certain extent in a place like Cuba, you know, things were pretty rough down there for a while. But even still under the boot of communism, things are getting better for them.
Yeah. And, you know, and I would suggest part of what brought communism down was the awareness of the West. That is, the people in the communist countries were just aware that there was another place where things were done differently. And it was really hard to keep the information out, namely the fact that things were going much better in the West. Right. And so that's just this constant pressure that there's just no way that the governments of these tyrannical countries can just keep people ignorant indefinitely. Right. And eventually people are going to have to they're going to demand change.
That's in the blend of, you know, trying to estimate what the future is going to look like and so forth like that. I think the advance in information exchange has, without using phrases like the genie's out of the bottle or stuff like that that's way overused, it is kind of true that what we're about to experience is unpredictable, because with the tremendous advance in communication and the amount of information and knowledge that's available for free to everybody almost, it's just like throwing out a giant handful of dice and trying to estimate what things are going to look like.
That's basically right. You know, we can only say some very broad general things. I think that expanding information, expanding access to information is overall a good thing, because what's going to happen is, well, people will find out about better ways of doing things than the way they're presently doing them, right? And, you know, it's hard to keep that information out. And when that happens, then there's just going to be this constant pressure, right? And by the way, I think, you know, the leaders of the communist nations kind of realized, like, even they kind of realized that their system wasn't working so well because they had access to the information about how things were in the West, right? I think this is kind of how things are in China. The Chinese government is just, they just realized that they couldn't compete with the capitalist world unless they became more capitalist.
Yeah, I think so. Before we wrap it up today, is there anything else that you wanted to cover that we haven't talked about, or maybe a website or anything that you want to plug on the show?
People can go to my website. I have a website at the University of Colorado. I do have a page that's about this, about the problem of political authority. By the way, there's a discussion of my book going on the Cato website, Cato Unbound. So people can look at that. There's a discussion involving me, Brian Kaplan, Tom Palmer, and Nicole Hassoun.
And I'll be sure and put a link in today's show notes to the Cato page that you're talking about there as well. Michael, thanks for coming on the show with me. I appreciate you taking the time and talking to me today, and I sure hope to see you at Porkfest.
Great. Thank you.
Folks, thanks for listening today, and remember to visit badquaker.com, where liberty is our mission. Thanks a lot, folks.